Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to 1A. Before we dive in, we'd like to know better who's listening to the show and how you're using podcasts. So please help us out by taking a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It takes less than 10 minutes and it would really help us out. Again, that's npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. Okay, thanks for listening. On to the show. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. August Wilson, John Edgar Wideman, Adrienne Kennedy, all black writers with strong ties to Pittsburgh. Now, that city might not spring to mind as a hub of black literary inspiration. Harlem, New York makes sense from the Harlem Renaissance, or Chicago, the birthplace of Ebony and Jet magazines. But in his new book, Damon Young writes about Pittsburgh, his hometown, and how much it influenced the writer he has become. He's the editor-in-chief and co-founder of the black cultural commentary website Very Smart Brothers. Here's how he describes it.
VSB's, we're known for a very punchy, very aggressive, very irreverent takes on pop culture, on politics, on race. And so if people want to come to the site, then they might be compelled to laugh. They might be compelled to, I don't know, sample some black food. I don't know. And they might be, you know, hopefully they're compelled to think. But mostly, I would want them to come back.
People did come back to Very Smart Brothers again and again. It started as a project between friends.
Then the blog just continued to grow, continued to gain audience and fans and followers or whatever. And it eventually led to me writing full time. Had a job at Ebony Magazine, and then I'm a columnist at GQ now. And then in 2017, VSB was acquired by Univision. And now we are, you know, a part of that whole Gizmodo Media Group network. And it also led to a book deal for me.
That book is called What Doesn't Kill Us Makes Us Blacker, a memoir in essays. Recently, Damon Young joined us in studio to talk about Pittsburgh, its influence on his writing, and why he stayed there after his career took off. Before we dive in, a quick heads up. Our conversation includes some strong racial language, including the N-word. And yes, it is necessary to tell his story properly. You'll see what we mean. Here's Damon Young on why he still calls Pittsburgh home.
When I started Very Smart Brothers in 2008, I was working at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. I was running a college prep program there. And I got laid off in 2009. It was just a casualty of the recession. And so much of VSB's growth and much of VSB's success, you know, stems from desperation.
Desperation?
Desperation. Stems from me, you know, not having a job. And, you know, knowing that in order to do this for a living, I had to get better at it. And I like having lights in my apartment. I like having a phone with a paid bill.
You get used to that.
Get used to that. Get used to water. You get used to living indoors. You get used to, you know, going to brunch maybe once a month or something like that. And so, much of, you know, that ambition or whatever that fueled me to grow VSB comes from just being scared to death. And so just to connect to your question about Pittsburgh, one of the reasons why I stayed is because of the cost of living. It's because that Pittsburgh went in comparison to other cities, other, you know, semi-major cities in the Mid-Atlantic and on the East Coast, is very, very cheap. And also I'm from there. And so I was able to survive with the little bit of money I was making in a way that I wouldn't have been able to in D.C.
Did you draw any kind of cultural inspiration from Pittsburgh's, you know, literary giants, August Wilson and so forth?
Of course I did. I mean, you can't be a Pittsburgher and not. And I think that the greatest inspiration, and I think this is a thing that, you know, that inspired them as well, is that Pittsburgh is so white demographically And it's not just a demographic whiteness. It's an atmospheric. It's a spiritual whiteness. Like Pittsburgh is like white. Pittsburgh is a jar of mayonnaise.
There's a line in the book where you say that it is so segregated that any place within a 10-mile radius of the city with more than 7 black people there at one time feels like the Essence Festival.
Yeah, that is not hyperbole. That is the truth. And the thing is, in order to have any sort of sanity as a black person in Pittsburgh, you have to be very intentional. You have to intentionally seek out, you know, community. You have to intentionally seek out spaces that are comfortable, that are welcoming. And I think that intentionality, you know, just bleeds into the work of people who are from Pittsburgh, where you have to, it's not a place where you could just laze into blackness. You have to be hypercognizant of it. And that hypercognizance, I think, is reflected in August Wilson's work, and John Edgar Wideman's work, and hopefully in my work too.
Let me get into some of that work, namely the memoir, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. In the intro, you write that to be black in America is to exist in a ceaseless state of absurdity. And a lot of the book's anecdotes lean into the absurd. I mean, some of them feel like prose versions of comedy sketches. They really are kind of absurd. But what is the absurdity that you're describing?
Well, the absurdity is just, you know, and I'm glad you brought up it. Sometimes it feels like a comedy sketch, where that hypercognizance of being black and, you know, being in white America, and you're wondering if a thing happened or a thing didn't happen because you're black. Thinking about how that impacts your decisions and how that impacts your thoughts and how that impacts your life. And also recognizing that there's an entire population of people who will deny that this even exists. That is absurd. Like it's rage inducing also. It's anger inducing also. It causes outrage, but it is like it is bizarre. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. And the book, you know, I think that so much of the conversation about blackness and about race in America exists at like these two like opposite ends of the spectrum, where you have the conversation about like the trauma, which are real and important conversations to have. And you also have the conversations about like the excellence, you know, the talented 10th and the Jack and Jill and the Ivy and HBCU and everything. And I'm neither of those things. And so my book deals more with anxiety, with neuroses, with self-consciousnesses, with fear, with doubt, and how all those things have converged to color just my entire experience.
You also deal to an extent with some of the petty things that you went through. You mentioned a high school nemesis.
Yes.
And you say that it's been more than 20 years, but you still silently kind of wish him ill. There's a part of the book called Street Cred where you lay out the kinds of things you wish for him. Here's some of the things that you write. You write, I hope that every time he runs for a bus, he misses it by seconds and is close enough to see both the bus pass by and the perfunctory shrug of feigned pity bus drivers tend to make when that happens. I hope that at least once a week he attempts to make spaghetti, and while transitioning the Giant Eagle brand angel hair pasta from the box to the pan, it slips from his hand and falls to the floor, and the 5-second rule doesn't work because the floor is covered with cat hair, because he's a grown-ass man with 4 cats, one of which wakes him every morning by blowing humid cat breath into his eardrum. Take a breath. What? Why are you so? Who is this man you so mad about? And why?
Yeah. This was a guy who, you know. So I played basketball in high school and college. I actually went to college on a basketball scholarship, and so the back of the bus on the high school basketball games was prime space for ripping. And ripping is a Pittsburgh area slang for playing a dozens or roasting or whatever.
Throwing insults.
Yeah, throwing insults at each other, whatever. I was never very good at that. And because I took things too personally, and I would want to fight, or I would just take it personally and be like, oh, He said, damn it. He said, I look like an ugly dolphin. I must look like an ugly dolphin.
You internalize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I would internalize. And so this guy, James Adams, wasn't one of our star players, but he had a sort of status in a school because he was, and this is a suburban high school, but he was like kind of sort of a Crip, kind of sort of a thug, whatever. And so he had like a status and he'd be on the back of the bus. And there was this one time coming back from an away game where he started ripping on me. And I just felt so bad about it. And I've still, you know, in the chapter talks about how he ripped on me and I didn't have enough confidence back then to go back at him. And I could have gone back at him very easily because while he pretended like he was from the hood, I even call him an instant oatmeal Crip at one point in the chapter. I actually was from the hood. I actually was from, you know, a neighborhood that wasn't the safest. I actually did have my house shot into. I actually did grow up on a block where there were Bloods and Crips and drive-bys and things of that nature. And here's this suburban kid with, you know, doing all this performance. And, you know, but at that time, I just didn't have the confidence to actually tell him about himself.
But you did something interesting as you put it in the book. You shut him down by kind of holding a mirror up to him. Like you describe, he's bragging about all the girls he's been with. And as you write it in the book, you said to him, you have hoes now, and that's great, but your life is never going to get better after this point, and mine will. High school will be the highlight of your life. So keep talking back here, telling jokes about me and having fun, and I'm going to go back to my seat to sit down.
I did say that. Yes, I definitely did say that to him. And a constant theme throughout the book is how important performance is in regards to masculinity and how we define ourselves. And so you have this socialized ideal of this like hyper hetero masculine ideal that we are socialized to reach. And because that is an ideal or that is like a benchmark that we all fall short of, there's a lot of performance. You know, there's a lot of faking, there's a lot of perpetrating. And you know, this happened when I was 15, 16 years old. That's 25 years ago. And now, looking back, I realize that, you know what? He was just performing, too. He was just trying to match whatever he believed he was supposed to be. And I, you know, for this period of time, had considered him to be like this villain in my narrative. But he was also a victim.
And yet, even knowing that, it's still hard to put it down.
And still, even with that, it's still hard to put it down. But it's still, you know, I have a sympathy for him and for just that whole experience that I definitely didn't then. And that I probably didn't even 10 years ago.
Let me ask you about your parents. They anchor the book in a lot of ways. And you explore a lot of the themes in the book through your experiences with them. First, let me talk about your father. There are two early descriptions of him in the book. You describe him in part as a black beatnik John Wick, referring to the Keanu Reeves action character.
Yeah.
And you also refer to him as John Shaft with an NPR membership. Now, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but it sounds like there's this duality in your dad that made him... What did that make him to you?
Oh, I mean, my dad... You know, he's still one of my best friends. He's my homie, and in that story, where I refer to him that way, it's talking about a time when my mom and my grandmother were called a nigger by this white boy who was working at this neighborhood deli, over a disagreement about like olives or salami or something, ice cream, and then they go and get my dad. My dad comes to the store. And again, my parents and my grandma, these are like NPR listening, Pat Metheny show attending, tea drinking, like my grandmother is white gloves on Sunday, church hat. So my dad comes back to the store, walks up to the white boy and it's like, you know, my wife and my mother-in-law just told me that you called him this thing. I'm going to give you an opportunity to apologize. And if you don't, I'm going to come behind this counter and I'm going to kick your ass with this 2x4. Because my dad was carrying a 2x4 in the trunk of the car. Because again, he's black beating at John Wick. And so the kid doesn't apologize. My dad starts counting to 10. And this kid, I mean, he should have known that if a black parent starts counting, once he stops counting, you need to duck because furniture is going to start moving.
Right. It's about to get real.
It's about to get real.
Very fast.
And so a fight happens. My dad has a 2x4. The guy behind the register has like a knife swinging at my dad. And this whole time, my mom and my grandmother are like breaking jars of olives and throwing salami and ice cream. And it's just a mess.
So it really went down.
It went down. Like the cops are called. Windows were broken. You know, shards of like racist glass and bigoted chunks of olives are on the street. And the cops come and they get arrested. And then they go to the station, and then like a black sergeant or lieutenant or something takes a look at them. You know, again, this is the white gloves, Pat Metheny listening, Steely Dan, you know, mixtape making, Bonneville driving people. It's like, yikes, what happened? Y'all do not belong here. What happened? They explain. And then she's like, you know what? I'm going to let y'all go. And they're like, well, what about if y'all Negroes don't get the hell out of here before these white people realize
get out of here.
That I'm letting you go.
Right.
And so that chapter talks about how I'm like 6, 7, 8 years old. I'm hearing a story. I had never been called a nigger to my face before, but I wanted a story like that.
Just ahead, writer Damon Young gets his wish. We'll talk to him about what happened the first time he was called the N-word and if it was as dramatic a story as what happened with his parents. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, NCR. Let's face it, as a small business owner, you wear so many hats every day, you rarely have time to focus on activities that drive profitability or bring in new customers. That's why you need a point of sale that does more. NCR Silver delivers simple-to-understand analysis and business-building tools like email marketing and loyalty so you can get back to focusing on your customers. NCR Silver. Search NCR Silver.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another. For the entire month of April, we're celebrating women in comedy. And we're kicking things off with Russian Doll actor Greta Lee and co-creator Leslie Headland. And later in the month, we'll be joined by Retta from NBC's Parks and Recreation and Good Girls. And many more. Start listening this Friday.
We're speaking to writer Damon Young, the editor-in-chief of the website VerySmartBrothers.com, also a columnist for GQ and the author of the new book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir in essays. In his book, Young reveals what happened the first time he was called the N-word, the version that ends with instead of He was a kid who liked to fight, and so he had high hopes for this moment. He imagined a gallant triumph over a brazen racist. But that's not quite how it turned out.
It happened. Yeah, it was a letdown because I was like 16 years old. I'm waiting for a bus. And some guy in an F-150 who looked exactly like Ricky Schroeder, who used to be on NYPD Blue and in Silver Spoons, looked as that. It might have been him. I'm still not sure if it wasn't him.
I hope it was not for his sake.
If you're listening, Ricky Schroeder, you know, I got a bone to pick to you with you if that was you.
And if you'd like to apologize, call us at 202-885. No.
And so he screamed out the window, and the car just kept going. And it's like, well, I've been waiting for this so I can fight the person who said this to me, but I can't. He's gone now. And just sitting there or standing there and just realizing how ridiculous it was to assign any measure of my racial identity to what a white person did or said to me, that, again, talking about the absurdity, you know, I start the book with that story. And I think that just sets the temperature for the sorts of absurd and bizarre situations that I end up getting into.
These are also, as you describe it, kind of the family lore. You know, the stories that ended up getting told, I imagine, time and time again.
And my dad is like my dad. He is like when the family gets together, and my dad has five brothers and three sisters. I come from a huge family, especially on my dad's side. He's the one who's telling the same story at every gathering. And, you know, to the point where I can anticipate when he's going to pause. I can anticipate when he's going to do like the dramatic thing that preachers do when they're pausing their story to get like a reaction. Maybe you like, I don't know, you get like a towel or you get a drink. It's like, oh yeah, this is part of the show.
Right.
This is part of his
routine. This is the part where you're supposed to say amen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You also talk about the financial situation of your family. Financial insecurity is one of the themes of the book, especially for your dad. He struggled a lot with employment. You know, you talk about, you know, the difficulties your family had in terms of finding a home in the right place or being able to have a car and, you know, not have it repossessed or break down, and just the way that that all locked together. How did your parents approach to finances, to just money and being able to sustain the family, affect the way you kind of handle it as an adult? How did that affect you?
So I'm in a situation now where I've had a decent amount of success over the last 3 or 4 years that has changed my financial circumstances pretty drastically. But I still feel like at any day, any hour, any second, it could be gone, almost like Thanos just snapping his fingers and half the universe is gone.
Why?
Because it can be. You know, I talk in the book about, I make an analogy about like a tsunami where, you know, people who, you know, maybe don't have as much success or are working class or are struggling, they're right on the coastline so that when the tsunami hits, they're the first ones. And what a degree does, what savings do, what like an income or what like a professional network, what that does, it allows you to live a little bit further inland. But you're not up on a hill. So maybe you don't get hit with a tsunami on day one, but you're not as protected as you might think you are either, because it can get you too. And so, you know, with my parents, you know, struggling with employment, and particularly my dad, and my mom being, you know, throughout my life, basically, or at least, you know, my upbringing, the only consistent source of income, living like that and having that experience, you know, that doesn't leave. And I don't want it to leave because I don't want to forget. I don't want to be uncentered. I don't want to have like the nigga wake up call that happens when people forget who they are. And then, you know, all of that privilege you think you have, all of that success you think that you've had, all of that protection that you think that you possess is just snatched away from you.
I think there are a lot of people who will hear that and see the title of your book and immediately say, why does it always have to be about race? Not that race doesn't matter, but this notion that your lens for the tenuousness of your success is a direct result, causally, purely of race, is exactly what's wrong with our conversation on race. That everything becomes racial, that there's never a way to sever race from the entirety of American experience, and being unable to sever those things ever makes it impossible to transcend issues of race. What would you say to that?
I would say that they are right. Race is like, you know, it's chapter one, page one, sentence one, word one of the American story. And to negate that and to try to pretend it isn't, you're obviously haven't read the book. When people have that question about, you know, why does it always have to be about race? There's this implication that blackness itself is pathological. And one of the things that I hope people get out of my book And one of the things that I hope just people get out of just my life and the work that I do is that, yes, we have existed under these adverse conditions, but there's joy also. There's humor also. There's love also. There's community also. You know, there is, and I would even say that because of that adversity, we are kind of forced to stretch our humanity as far as it can be stretched and love a little bit harder and hug a little bit tighter and dap a little bit longer and search for spaces where we could have that community and search for spaces where we could have some sort of respite and search for just those little twinkles of colony. And so, yeah, race can't be separated from any story about America, particularly any story that a black person tells about America. And I wouldn't want it to be.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay close.
Now that ISIS has lost all its territory, what happens to the people ISIS left behind?
She chose to take herself out there. She should stay in Syria and rot.
And what about their children? How It Ends, a new series on Embedded.
We're speaking to Damon Young, author of the book What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir and essays, also the editor-in-chief of VerySmartBrothers.com and a columnist for GQ. I did want to ask you about your mother. She's a very prominent figure throughout the book. You speak of her as being very warm. There's a lot of humor around the way that you describe her. You describe a plot where you and your dad kind of hid from her that you had been kicked out of school for, really. And the expression on your face when I brought that up, I could see you go back in time, and you feel like there's a weight that you just put on when I reference that. Am I reading you wrong?
No, you're not. You know, in the story that you're referencing talks about how I was attending a suburban high school, but I lived in the city. And once they found out I lived in the city, I got kicked out of school. I had to attend a school that was a block away from where we lived.
You basically had to lie about what your address was to get into the suburban school.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, I was 15 years old when this happened. And even writing that and thinking about that and reading that, it's just really just, I don't know, it's almost, it's very embarrassing. And it was at the time, but it even is, you know, at 40 and thinking back at a thing that happened 25 years ago, it still is. And so my mom, it'll be 6 years since she passed. She died in 2013. She had lung cancer. And one of the last chapters in the book talks about her. And it talks about how before she was diagnosed with cancer, she had been complaining about back pain, about headaches, about stomach aches for years. And the doctors, you know, didn't really take her pain seriously. Would tell her to, you know, maybe she needed to get more exercise. Maybe she needed to take Advil. Maybe she needed to take less Advil. Maybe she needed to drink less pop. And I can't help but wonder if she happened to be white, instead of this working class black woman from Pittsburgh, from Belmont Gardens, if the doctors would have taken her pain more seriously and maybe caught the cancer before it got to a place where there was really nothing they could do about it.
There's another aspect to the way you describe what happened to your mom in terms of the way that black women are depicted in a larger sense. In part, you write, I think about how praise of black women reads like a word association game where someone just placed strength in a thesaurus and found the synonyms. Black women are stout. Black women are unyielding.
Black women are stable. Black women are durable. Black women are stalwart. Black women are firm. Black women are poised. Black women are reliable. Black women have grace, too. But grace is just another way of praising them for being strong for everyone else while also juggling and then ignoring the urge to firebomb the entire effing planet.
Yeah. And, you know, my mom is one woman. And yeah, we've seen all the studies about how, you know, even today, doctors believe that Black people have like the supernatural tolerance for pain. And we've seen the infant mortality rates. We've seen the disparities, you know, particularly when it comes to like Black women in healthcare. And I guess where the deepest neurosis exists is the distance between that information, that knowledge, and that feeling that I'm 99.99999% certain that my mom's race impacted how she was treated, but I'm not 100% certain. Can I say without a shadow of a doubt that if she were a white woman, that the doctors would have treated her differently? No, I can't say that. I believe it. I feel it. But I can't prove it with 100% certainty. And that little tiny bit of uncertainty is like that. That is what can make you crazy.
Talk about now that you're married, you're a father, you've got a child of your own. Reflecting back on your childhood, now raising a child yourself, what's that been like for you?
We actually just welcome another child too. I have a son, Levi. He's 4 months old.
Oh, congratulations!
Now, thank you. Thank you.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. You know, and I think this is a universal feeling that parents have, where you want your child to experience, you want to pass on the good things from you, and you don't want to pass on the bad things. You want them to have what you believe to be your best characteristics, you know, almost like some sort of Instagram filter where you you want to give them like the best angles and the best filters. And you don't want them to have like the blemishes and the imperfections or whatever. But it's impossible to do that. And one of the reasons why is because very often those great characteristics and those unflattering characteristics come from the same place. Like, for instance, with me, I have always been a person who has been just very chill, very thoughtful, very almost immune to peer pressure. Like, I've always kind of just done my own thing. And that's a part of me that I think is a good part of me. But I also sometimes struggle with being assertive. I also sometimes overthink. And overthink so much that I end up just being paralyzed with thought and I don't do anything. And that overthinking has given me acid reflux, where it has literally affected my physiology. And I take pills, I have to alter my diet. And so that good thing and that bad thing come from the same place.
Damon Young is the editor-in-chief of VerySmartBrothers.com and a GQ columnist. His new book is called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir in essays. Damon, thanks for talking
to
us.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Stacia Brown and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at theoneA.org/staff. And again, please, please, please remember to fill out that short podcast survey. It's online at npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.